It was at that moment that I realized how vital art is. That it's not just million-dollar pieces hanging on a museum wall behind a piece of glass. That, you know, cliche as it sounds, it literally builds communities. It brings people back together. It brings meaning to life. And that was the moment when I realized that I didn't want to dedicate my life to pursuing some gallery position, selling artwork to the 1%. You know, I wanted to help rebuild. I wanted to help create connection. And I saw art as the vehicle. For me, art has always been a vehicle. It is not a purpose in and of itself. I do recognize that for some people it is. And I think the work that they make is beautiful, but for me, art is the means and human connection and finding meaning through life. That's the purpose. That's what art helps us do.
This is the Cracking Creativity Podcast, episode number 51 with Miranda Ashleen. Welcome to the Cracking Creativity Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Chung. And I'm here to show you how creatives turn their ideas into action, create interesting projects, and build an engaged audience through shared passions. Now let's get creative. In this episode of the Cracking Creativity Podcast, I talked to Miranda Ashleen. Miranda found her passion at a very young age. She went to college at the age of 14, and by her junior year, two things became very clear to her. The first was deciding to open up an art center. The second was a trip to El Salvador that changed her life. In this episode, learn about her work as an artist, community builder, and creator of Miranda's Hearth, the first community art hotel. Now on to the episode. Welcome to another episode of Cracking Creativity. Today I'm on Miranda Ashleen, and she is an abstract painter, a singer-songwriter, an actual writer. She went to college at the age of 14. She's given a TEDx talk. She is doing a project called Miranda's Hearth, which I'll let her talk about in a moment. And she's worked or taught at the Museum of Fine Arts and has a book called Don't Make Art, Just Make Something. That's quite a list of things you got going for you. Can you tell us a little bit more about yourself and kind of what you're doing?
Sure. I mean, like you said, yeah, it's quite the list. I've turned myself into a jack of all trades, master of none. And part of that is because I fall into the role of arts organizer, and I'm interested in bringing people together and building connections between different things that might at first seem disparate. And the best way I found to do that is that I experiment in a lot of different realms. So I may not be, you know, an expert soloist on the piano, but I played piano for long enough that I can communicate with the person who does study it, you know, professionally. And then I can also communicate with the person who's a professional writer because I've spent time doing that. So I've really spent a lot of time exploring different venues and trying to see how they all overlap, how you can get them to work together, and what you can learn by doing lots of different things, because I've found that my creative process is actually pretty consistent whatever the medium.
Can you talk a little bit about what you did when you were growing up? Like, what kinds of creative things did you do, and how did that lead to what you decided to do in college and eventually what you're doing now?
Yeah. So I was never really a virtuoso of any kind. I took piano lessons for a long time. I absolutely hated it for the first 10 years. And I remember I finally liked piano lessons when I played Fury Lease when I was in fifth grade. And because of that, you know, years and years later, I still have that piece memorized because it was so fundamental for me to feel like I wasn't just learning technique, but I was actually learning something that would express you know, what I was interested in, what I was capable of. So that was one of my earliest experiments with kind of the arts in general. The rest of it was much more exploratory. I mean, I've always been a knitter. I've always done fiber arts. So I've made quilts. I've made my own clothes. And I always did that, just kind of experimenting in the basement. Like, I never followed patterns. I hated following patterns. So I just sat down with a bunch of materials and saw what happened. I guess kind of the best example of that was my older sister, who is much more precise than I am. We walked into Michael's together when I was a kid, and I'll never forget it. I walked up and I grabbed this like fuzzy black yarn and this stringy multicolored rainbow yarn. And I was like, I'm going to make the coolest scarf out of these two things. And she just looked at me with this like older sister, like, you know, patronization, and was like, psh. And she admitted to me several years later, she was like, I was always so jealous that you could take these different objects and turn them, and at first it looks like nothing will come of it, and then it turns into something really cool, which is what happened with that scarf, if I do say so myself. but so I guess that was always my approach to creativity, and I was really encouraged as a child, both through my parenting and through my schooling, to explore, to play. I've always found learning really fun. I never had that kind of trained out of me, like I think a lot of children unfortunately do. And so, you know, I tried all these different things, and when I got to college, like you said, I went to college when I was young, so I wasn't quite on the career path yet. When I was in college, I was 14, and I was just, you know, taking the things that interested me, and I wasn't thinking about paying bills and paying student loans. I think if I had gone to college when I was 18, I probably would have been like a biologist or a sociologist or something much more practical. but because I went to college when I was 14, I didn't know what I was going to major in, but I took my first art class and it just hooked me. And I decided to get into the arts more seriously. You know, I've always been doing it. But and my parents were really supportive of that. But my mother, who studied theater, she said, well, you should absolutely get an art degree if that's what you want to do, but you have to think about what you're going to do with it. Which was actually really great advice. It made me think about teaching. It made me think about art therapy and architecture. And it's what in the end led me to the path that I'm on, being a community artist. So I've always kind of balanced that exploratory encouragement with a really practical, realistic approach to what it means to make a living out of being an artist.
What drew you to being a community artist as opposed to like a solo artist?
Well, it was really that question actually from my mother. She did the, like, she moved to New York when she was 18 and she was an intern at Juilliard and she worked theater and worked her ass off. And, you know, she did that lifestyle. And she warned me that it's really hard to do. And so when I was in school, I was studying painting and I was trying to think about what I wanted to do with my art. Did I want to be a solo artist and try and do that? Or did I want to do something else? And I was leaning towards doing something else for the most part because I wanted my art to maintain its disconnection in a sense. I'm really glad that I've never made money off of my art. Like, I've made, you know, I've sold a couple paintings here and there, but I've never needed the money that I make off of my art. And I think that's really freeing for my art. That being said, I do think that my entire career is based out of art and creativity. And what drew me to community art in particular is that I was originally studying art and psychology, and I realized that I would make a terrible therapist. because I work much better on the macro scale than the micro scale. And I kind of view community art as art therapy for a community, which is obviously much more macro than art therapy, which is often one-on-one and much more, you know, deeply involved. And it's really important, you know, for the people who do that. But I needed to think more broadly because I am the type of person who likes to work in broad strokes.
What kind of classes did you take while you were in college? Because you said you experimented with a lot of different things. What was the first thing that you took that was like, oh, this is what I kind of want to do?
Oh, well, That's a really, wow, I haven't been asked that question before. I was really indecisive in college. I was actually a double major and a triple minor because I just wanted to do it as possible. So I majored in painting and pottery. I minored in piano performance and psychology and art history. And then I was at a liberal arts college, so I ended up taking classes like medical sociology and calculus. And I actually think those were some of the classes that stuck out the most for me. And it made me really glad that I didn't go to a pure art school, because I did have this rounded education. And, you know, medical sociology is still a fascinating subject to me. And I think the things that I learned there informed the work that I do as a community artist more than, possibly, you know, the drawing classes that I took. The most influential class actually in my major, though, was probably one that I took. I think it was the end of my freshman year. We had like a May term, you know, class that was 3 weeks in one course at the end of your spring semester. And I took this class called Materials as Metaphor. And it was just, it was taught by this wonderful, wonky woman named Martha. And she just encouraged us to experiment as much as possible, which, like I said, is how I've always learned best. And, like our sketchbook for that class was actually an encyclopedia. She gave each of us an encyclopedia and encouraged us through the class to draw on it and tear at it and completely destroy something that, you know, carried important intellectual information that you're told never to mishandle in that way. And the premise for the class was tearing that apart. And then we just let loose. We were making art out of welding or melting plastic bags together. And I remember I made a raincoat poncho out of plastic bags. So that kind of open-ended exploration was really important to me. I did not go to a technique-driven school. I'm not a technique-driven artist or really person. And while sometimes I wish I could sit down and draw a perfect sphere, it was really important to my artistic development that I was in a program that encouraged me to just play around, to try, to figure out what worked best for me as far as developing my voice.
One thing that really interests me is the idea of experimentation versus knowing what works. So how do you balance experimenting on things and knowing what you should continue to do when it works?
Well, I think how you find out what works is through experimentation. You know, I'm an abstract artist. So there were times when I would throw something at the canvas and it would drip the wrong way and I'd be like, well, shit, that was a bad idea. And then I wouldn't do that again. Or there would be a time where one of my favorite tools that I use in my paintings are actually these little rug samples that kind of, they're like pom-poms with cardboard around them so that it feels like a little rug texture that I gathered when the interior design department closed and they had all these random materials. And I used that like a sponge on my paintings. And I thought that was fascinating. I still use it. It's been, you know, 5 or 6 years and I'm still using these same rug samples. I would say that, you know, the point of learning established techniques is to learn from what other people have already experimented with. You know, you shouldn't have to recreate perspective because people spent years and years and years figuring out how to do that well. So they did the experimentation so that you don't have to. So you learn the basics. And different people have different levels of the basics they want to learn. I used perspective as an example, but I'm actually terrible at perspective. But I think everything is learned through experimentation. I think one of my favorite things that I did in school was studying pottery. And what's so fascinating about pottery as an art form is that unlike oil painting, which has a very specific timeline and geographic history, like you can trace, you know, when people started painting on canvas in Venice, back through the Egyptian tempera paintings, and it's, you know, piece by piece by piece. But pottery was made all over the world independently, and it's probably because people just, you know, made a fire on top of wet mud, and suddenly it wasn't wet mud anymore. So everybody experimented, and they came out with these same things. And if you look at the history of pottery, you can see the similarities that people developed all across the world without having any form of communication.
That's really interesting because it brings me to a point that you made somewhere. I think it was in your TED Talk that just by doing things, you'll discover different things, and people from different areas will try different things, and maybe sometimes they will come up with a similar idea.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting.
Thank you. That actually, I mean, that I guess that concept is directly from what I was just talking about with pottery, with my thesis, is for my senior thesis in pottery, I made dinner plates inspired by the Jomon Japanese culture, the Mimbres Native Americans, and the ancient Greeks. And the point was exactly what I just said, which is that these people were separated literally by oceans, and they also existed in completely different time eras. And yet, if you look at their techniques and their designs, they actually are fairly similar. You know, there's differences, of course, because they were invented uniquely. But the similarities are there in what we make, and definitely different people can come up with the same concept by following either the same or different accidental experiments.
I don't know if you've watched this video. It's called Everything is a Remix by Kirby Ferguson, and it's greatly shows you how people bring inspiration from different disciplines to create something new. So it's kind of like everyone is going to create something new, but it's based on other principles.
Yeah, I haven't heard that one, but it makes me think of Austin Kleon's Steal Like an Artist.
Yeah. Same thing, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was actually, this is not a quote that I was going to pull out, but I referenced that in my book. And one of my favorite quotes in the book is from him. And he says, "A wonderful flaw about human beings is that we're incapable of making perfect copies. And our failure to copy our heroes is where we discover where our own thing lives. And that is how we evolve."
Yeah. Even when you try to mimic people, even if you're like tracing something, it's not going to turn out the same.
Right.
Which is really interesting.
Yeah, and I love that concept of our imperfections are what make us beautiful. It's the same quote, you know, the quote in Good Will Hunting? Do you know that movie?
I know the movie. I'm not sure which quote you're talking about.
Matt Williams goes on this long thing trying to convince Matt Damon to be less of a perfectionist. Of course, this is their characters. And he talks about, you know, the importance of imperfections and how it's the imperfections that make us fall in love with each other and with the world. And I think that's really important, both within building communities and with creating art, that, like Kleon says, you can try and make something perfect and you can mimic it perfectly, but it's actually in the way you can't make it the same that you find your own voice.
And I think even if you tried to recreate something that you did previously, it would be very difficult to do the same thing.
Oh yeah. I mean, the kind of art that I do, God, no, I would never be able to recreate any of my paintings. I purposely make them. I like the fact that they are, you know, not one in a million, but they're unreproducible. I couldn't do it again. And I couldn't tell you how I did it in the first place. It's just about the actual process, being in there and mixing the paints and outlining the forms and reacting to what's on the canvas, which later is covered up and you don't even see. All you see is the reactions, not the initial spark.
Mm-hmm. That brings up the point of your book, which is just to start making something. Can you talk about the origins of the book? Because I believe it started as your thesis, and then how it evolved into what it is.
Yeah, so it was. It was my master's thesis. I moved to Boston in 2011. Yeah, and started going to Lesley University, where I was getting my master's of education in community art. And what I really wanted to do at that point, and what still fascinates me, is to create a creativity training program for doctors, lawyers, and businessmen to help reintroduce creativity and the importance of art into daily lives. But at this point, while I was thinking about my thesis, I was a 19-year-old graduate student. And I realized, you know, who is going to listen to some 19-year-old kid tell them how to use creativity to do their job better? And I felt really defeated when I first thought that, because I was so passionate about this concept. And I think it's really important. I think reintroducing creativity and curiosity and a desire to learn is vital to just about any profession. But it was from my defeat that I came up with, or defeatism, that I came up with the concept for the book. Because what I wanted to create was, in my mind, a piece of art. It was this program that would train people, that would help people grow, that would contribute to the world in this really grand way. And I felt completely unprepared to do that. And I think that moment is where most people stop. When you look at something that you want to do, when you come up with the inception and the idea and you take that first breath before trying to make it, and you realize that there's no way in hell you're going to make what's in your mind. And so that's where the concept of the book came from, was to kind of step back from art, because art is such a heavy term for such a simple little word. It has so many associations and so much weight to it, so many stigmas, that it's really easy to get bogged down in art before you even put pencil to paper or fingers to strings. And I find this for myself, is that if my idea gets too big and weighty, then there's no way that I'm going to do it. So I always try and break things down into manageable pieces. I say, you know, I'm not going to make an art piece. I'm not going to make a masterpiece. I might not even make a painting. I'm just going to make something. I'm just going to make sure that I do something. And hopefully in the long run, you do enough little somethings and they grow into other somethings that it becomes a piece of art. But I think if you start by trying to make art, you'll be so intimidated that you'll never make anything at all. But if you start with just attempting to make something, whatever it is, wherever it goes, then at least you'll start along the path. And I think that's one of the hardest parts of creating.
I think you gathered a lot of examples from different people. Can you talk about some of the surprising examples of people who just started making something?
Yeah. I mean, I guess one of the most recent ones came from one of my monthly events. I host dinner, art, and music nights down in Boston, or actually in Harvard Square. And the point is to bring together the community that I've started under my business, Miranda's Hearth, and to get people from different venues to make things together. And one of the members of Miranda's Hearth, Ryan Bonaparte, he's also an author. He wrote a book called Crazy Enough to Try, which is about finding your passion. And he writes a monthly blog post for me from the point of view of an engineer surrounded by artists. So he is constantly the one in the group who I'm like, okay, everybody, pick up your orange pastels and draw on this bright turquoise piece of paper and it'll be beautiful. And he's looking at me like, what the hell do you want me to do right now? Like, I know that look on his face so well at this point. And he's wonderful and he does it and he tries. And the recent post that he wrote is, I tried to make something, you know, ... and it worked. And he was talking about this mural project that we did at the October Dinner Art Music Night, where I gave people a series of steps to follow that created enough structure that it was comfortable for people to put pen to paper. So they were just, you know, draw a circle, draw a line between a circle, shade in the circle in some way, you know, draw a design in between two circles. And slowly you take the structure away to allow people to grow more. And Ryan wrote about this moment. He's like, well, I'm surrounded by all of these artistic people, all of these people who've trained this capability that I don't have. And he took this piece of charcoal and eventually that, you know, he quieted it down enough that he could try. And he ended up making this really, really interesting little wedge shape. And he turned the wedge shape into this cool circle. And then he kept filling it, and somebody, unbeknownst to both of us, was watching him do this. And they looked over and then he said, "Ryan, that's so cool. How did you do that? Like, I can't even think about how you did that." And I wish you could have seen him when he showed them. He was just glowing as he showed them how to make this little wedge shape. And and it was wonderful to see that for somebody who usually, like, you ask him to pick up charcoal and he's like, "Oh God, it smears. I can't draw an exact engineering design because it smears." He was so happy to be able to share this little experiment that he'd just come up with. And it happened because he was in a structured environment where he felt comfortable to experiment, to just try to make something, even if he didn't know what he was making. And coming from an engineering background, I think it's often more difficult for him to do that. And I use him as an example this specifically because he just wrote about this and talks about it a lot. But I think this happens for a lot of people, that it's hard to just make that first step because he didn't know. It could have been just an ugly smear on the paper, or it could have been a really cool thing that somebody else highlighted.
Hmm. I think that demonstrates the point of giving ourselves and each other labels and how that prevents us from doing things, even though, you know, why not even try? Because, oh, I'm not going to try because I'm an engineer. But if you knock that label down and just be open to doing things, you can discover something you'd never would have done before.
Absolutely. I think labels can be incredibly dangerous. They can also be incredibly helpful. The reason they're dangerous is what you said, is you get too comfortable and you fall into it and you think, you know, oh, this is what I do. This is, and I'm not good at this other thing because of that. There's actually some really interesting data about the fact that America in particular has an education system that believes in the concept of natural talent. You know, you either are good at math or you're not good at math. You are good at art or you're not good at art. You are an athlete or you're not an athlete. And this is something that Carol Dweck is a psychologist who writes about this, and she calls it the fixed mindset. This is what I have. I have so much of this, and I have to defend it. The other way of approaching it is the growth mindset. It was a TED Talk, actually, and I'm, of course, blanking on the name, that compared different countries' systems. And in Japan, it said that if you ask students, you know, are you good at math, they don't just say yes or no. They say yes, because I have studied really hard, or no, because I haven't tried hard enough. You know, they recognize that it's not this natural inborn talent. It's something that takes effort. And so I think that's why labels can be destructive. On the other hand, at least in creativity, there's a form of empowerment that comes when you finally feel ready to take on the label of an artist or a musician, when you finally feel like you've worked hard enough to feel comfortable calling yourself an artist. And I remember really specifically, because I was an art major in school, but I would not call myself an artist in school. I was an art major. I was just somebody who's studying art, you know, who was trying to figure out how to do it. And it was when I was standing in my gallery show after 4 years of education surrounded by large abstract oil paintings that I had created, that I looked around and I was like, oh, I am an artist, you know, like I'm doing this. And it was so, it's kind of like butterflies when you first meet someone, like that level of emotion connected with just recognizing that I was an artist. And it still took me years to be able to say it comfortably. I was like, after that show, I could kind of say it to myself, and I could write it in my journals, and I could whisper it to other people, but I wasn't walking around being like, oh yeah, I'm an artist. It took several more years for me to be comfortable announcing myself as such. But as I've gotten more comfortable, it's meant, you know, well, if I really am an artist, which I do identify as such, I need to make sure I actually spend time in a studio. You know, so I think in some ways labels can be helpful as long as you are aware of what they are doing and what they are constructing.
Mm-hmm. I think what you are going through and what everybody goes through, but we try not to think of it like this, is the imposter syndrome where you're like, oh, there's no reason I should be this, right? But no one is truly an expert. So there's always somebody that's going to be better than you, even if it's at a very particular skill within what you're doing. So you just forget about trying to be like the expert because you'll probably never reach it.
Yeah, figuring out what it means to be an expert is fascinating, I think. Being a teacher really changed that for me because I would teach, you know, tours at the Museum of Fine Arts, and there's no way you're going to have a, you know, encyclopedic memory of all of the artwork held in the Museum of Fine Arts. So, you know, I would be sitting down crafting these tours and I would be looking up the artwork like an hour before the people showed up to make sure that I knew what I was talking about. And then like an hour later, I would be standing in front of these people and I would be the expert imparting the wisdom. So I think a lot of the concept of being an expert comes from confidence, you know, whether it's honest or not. But I think, again, it's that label of, you know, most experts, I would assume, or I would hope, just like you say, the wisest people always know what they don't know. And I think the further you go into your realm of expertise, the more you realize you don't know about the rest of the world or about your own expertise. I think it's an interesting question about whether anybody actually is an expert. I mean, there definitely are masters. You know, people who are really, really good at what they do, and they've earned that title. But what does that actually mean?
Yeah, when there's so much to learn and do, even someone like Albert Einstein didn't think he was like a genius because he's like, there's so much I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, and he's like, I mean, if you want to know quotes about creativity and education, just look through that man's books. Like, the way he thought, the reason he's known as a genius was actually exactly what you just said. It was because he was so aware of the things that he didn't know. And he was so open to that. I say this as someone who has never actually studied Albert Einstein and just heard lots of quotes. I'm admitting I am not an Einstein expert here.
Yeah. I think the best point is that you should always be willing to ask questions. The best philosophers in the world, or like in ancient times, they got the knowledge that they had because they were willing to and open to ask the questions that most people aren't.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think, you know, creativity has become kind of a buzzword if you're talking with educators and business people and whatnot. But one thing that isn't mentioned as often, I think, is curiosity. And to me, curiosity really is the root of creativity. You know, artists are the people who sit there and they ask, and then they try to express what they find, whether they can or not, or through expressing, they try and find the answers. And I think, you know, a lot of the issues that our school system are currently facing, and Obama finally recognized this when he was talking about the issues of standardized testing recently, is that by playing to a test, we beat out curiosity because we say there is an answer. This is the right answer. This is what it is. And if you tell me it back, you'll be correct and you'll pass and you'll move on. But manifesting curiosity and is actually really humbling, you know, and I think that's true for experts. I think that's true for artists, is to develop your humble curiosity in the world is what makes you continue to create. And of course, ask questions.
Yeah. The root of innovation is like, how can I do something?
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Just like, how can I accomplish this? And whatever route it takes me is the one that is going to work, right?
Right, right. So, and so often it's, or not even always how, but just what happens if, ... You know, innovation is so often, you know, the question of whether you can make anything original anymore is a whole nother deep, dark rabbit hole. But I think most innovation comes from combining two pre-existing things in a new way because you asked how or why or what happens if. And I think that's where all progress comes from.
I think another thing is that just because it's been done before doesn't mean you can't do it better or in a different way that works for a different purpose, right?
Right. Well, and that goes back to Austin Kleon's quote of, you know, just because it's been done before, it's never been done the way that you can do it. Because you will never be able to do it the way someone else did. And that's not a bad thing because they already did it that way. So you shouldn't want to do it that way. You should try and figure out your own expression of it. And that's why, you know, that's why we're still doing the same Shakespearean plays and we're still singing the same Bach pieces and we're still playing the same Mozart, you know, because every time it's created, every time it's reinvented, it has new depths to it. It has new levels. And the people who really appreciate those old artworks appreciate the reincarnations and the revitalizations that come with each new performance.
Yeah, and I think it's Joseph Campbell's Hero with a Thousand Faces, where every story can be summed up into one of these categories of story. And they've all been done, but how can you do it in a way that's different or unique from the other ones?
Mm-hmm. And I mean, as a community artist, and I performed actually as a storyteller when I was studying community art, I think a big part of it is the people, not only the people who are creating it, but the people who are absorbing it, the audience. Because the way you learn a story to tell it as a storyteller is you memorize the first line and you memorize the last line. But then in between, you don't memorize verbatim the story. You memorize, and this is a quote from my teacher in storytelling, which I adore. You memorize the bones of the story. Mm-hmm. So that each time you tell it, you flesh it out and you bring it to life in a new way. And it's changed depending on the people who are around you and the time of day and what's happened in the world lately and what's happening in the room at the moment and whether it's light outside or whether it's cold outside. I mean, it just, if you allow it to have that regeneration each time you tell the story. And like I said at the beginning of the interview, I apply my creative processes across the board. So I think this is also true with each new piano performance, with each new painting you make. You reinterpret it for a new way depending on how you're fleshing out the bones of the concept.
I think people can actually tell the difference when you're like doing rote memorization and playing that versus something where you actually put your feelings and emotions into it, because it just, there's a different feel to it.
Mm-hmm. And not to say that memorized work cannot be improvised. I mean, I played classical piano for 12 years and every time I played Fury Lease, it was different. It was the same notes, hopefully, but depending on, you know, if I were playing it for my mother, I would probably play it for a different way than if I was playing it for my piano instructor. Or, you know, the people who you are creating for have just as much of an impact on your artwork as you do.
Yeah. It's just about, like, your surroundings, everything you're going through, and, like, everything has an impact on everything else.
Mm-hmm.
I want to go back to the group that you started, the Dinner Art and Music. How did you actually get that started? Because that's not something people do every day.
No, it's got kind of a long history. I'm one of those obnoxious people who's always known exactly what I wanted to do with my life. And it's evolved, of course. But I knew when I was 16, and mind you, I was a junior in college when I was 16, so it's a little bit different. But I knew then that I wanted to start a community art center. I had gone, when I was in my sophomore year in college, on this life-changing trip to El Salvador. And it was like, if my life were a Hallmark movie, it would be the climactic turning point that changed me from a clueless kid into a woman with a passion. And at that point, I knew I wanted to start a community art center. And I thought for a long time about what it would be and how to do it. And that's why I came to Boston. That's why I went to Lesley to study community art. And while I was at Lesley, I came up for the idea of Miranda's Hearth, which is not just a community art center. It's going to be the first community art hotel. And the concept is to take a rundown old building and revitalize it through the arts, turning all of the old rooms into functional hotel rooms where everything inside, from the food to the furniture, is handmade by local artists. And then when people come and stay, they can buy what they use in their rooms, buy something like it in the gallery, or take a class and learn how to make it for themselves. And the goal is what I've developed as kind of my personal mission in life, which is to help reconnect art to daily life, to break down the boundaries that are often created by art institutions of grand sizes, and help people realize that creativity and art really is everywhere. And the reason I wanted to do this is that I had a kind of transformational class called Ideas into Action when I was in grad school. And it was taught by Kit Jenkins, who's one of the founders of Raw Artworks up in Lynn. And Raw, if you've ever been there, is just what an art center should feel like. I mean, it's just incredible. But she admitted to our class that she spends 75% of her time fundraising to do the actual work 25% of the time. And I decided at that moment that I wanted to come up with a business concept that made it so I didn't have to spend my life fundraising. It means instead I have to spend my life doing business organization, but, you know, for me that was much more applicable. And that's where the hotel idea came from. Now, I do not come from a wealthy background. I don't have the money to go and buy some grand building and hope that people just show up. So I decided 2 years ago, while I was finishing my master's program, to start hosting events in order to build the community first, so that they can help me make the actual building. So I tried a lot of different things. I tried a meetup group. I tried something called an art circle, which was inspired by a book called Making Ideas Happen by Scott Belsky. And none of them really worked. And then I decided to have music, art, and wine nights in my apartment. And if you know anything about, you know, creative people in their 20s, you give them free wine and food and they'll show up. So I started in July of 2013 with four people and myself in my 80-something degree second floor apartment with no air conditioning, and the wine was sweating and the Milanos were melting, and we just played music all night and talked about our different projects and our different, you know, goals, and told each other about what we were doing. And since then, I've done them every single night, or excuse me, every single month. It's been over 2 years now, and the community has just grown astronomically, not necessarily in size, but in depth, because now these people have met every month, and they know each other, and they have histories with each other, and they've helped each other on projects. So we quickly kind of outgrew the music, art, and wine night structure, which were all just happening in my apartment. And that's when we changed to the dinner, art, and music nights at the Democracy Center. So now they're public events that people come to, and we have a different feature every month trying to encourage different people from different disciplines to interact with each other, to try new things, like my friend Ryan, the engineer, drawing. And it's still about creating this community, the mission of which is to build a community through creativity that is affordable, accessible, and approachable. And hopefully over time, we'll start to work together to find land to actually do the concept of Miranda's Hearth. But until then, we'll continue to meet every month, and we'll make things together, and we'll learn about each other, and we'll continue to grow. And, you know, that's enough in and of itself.
That's awesome. I think it shows the impact that a strong, connected network can make on anybody's life, because without those other people, you really have nothing, right?
Absolutely. I completely believe that. And it grew out of my desire to have a community, really, because I moved to Boston when I was 17. I had a college degree, but no money and tons of loans. And I knew no one. None of my family is in this area. And so in addition to this whole business concept, I started the community that I wanted to be a part of. And it's been really fundamental for you know, my stability and my growth professionally and personally. Because all that really matters when you come, when it comes down to it, is genuine human connection. And I think the reason so many people are drawn to art, is that it is one of the best conductors of human connection.
Yeah, I think if anyone looks at the time that they spend doing anything, it's mostly interacting with the arts, whether that's like TV, certain TV, movies, music, like everything that you brings you enjoyment is pretty much based around some sort of thing in the arts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I think not a lot of people realize that. Part of my TED Talk was one of the things that I came down to is that unless you're standing on an untouched forest in the middle of nowhere, everything around you was at some point made by someone. You know, we live in these fabricated worlds, and yet we rarely stop to think about who made them or why or how. So the concept of the hotel is to put it, is to break down those barriers and connect the people who make things to the people who use things, connect the artist to the audience and the creator to the consumer. You know, because if you're lying in a bed under a handmade quilt in a hotel room that's been there for 10 years, you think about all the other people who have used it. You think about the woman who made it. You think about where she made it. And then you go down in the morning and you get to meet the woman who made the quilt that you slept under, and you get to talk to her. And if you really like her, you get to take a class with her and learn how to make it yourself. You know, because it's about caring about the human behind the art that art comes to be more meaningful in our lives. I think what art really does is that it signifies a story. It signifies a connection. And honestly, the art itself is not very important to me. I always say that you could burn all of my paintings and I'd be upset, but I wouldn't be destroyed, because to me, what's important is not a painting. It is to be painting. It is being in the room and creating, and it is the story that I make while in that room, and the story that I can then share with everyone else.
Hmm. I think the mistake many artists make is not being able to express what they're feeling when they're creating, because that is pretty much the thing that people are trying to connect with, right? When you see a piece of art, especially if it's abstract, it's like, what is this bringing in me, and what does this mean between me and the person who created it and everything surrounding me?
Well, it's an interesting concept, especially in abstract art, because some abstract art is very emotionally driven and emotion-based, and some of it, it's completely technical, it's completely form-driven, and, you know, the artist who made it doesn't really care if you emotionally connect with it. They want you to look at it and observe it. And I think it's actually kind of, it makes a lot of sense that artists can't talk about what they do, because if they would talk, if they could talk about the way they felt, if they could talk about the drive to create, then they wouldn't create, they'd just talk, you know? I was talking to a friend of mine about this who studied philosophy. He's actually one of the newest members of Miranda's Hearth, and, you know, he said one of the things he envies from artists is their ability to express. And I think many artists find their medium because it is how they expressed. Like I was telling you earlier, before we were interviewing, that I'm not an audio learner, that I'm a very visual person. I'm a very kinesthetic person. So it makes sense that my form is painting, that my form is dancing, and interacting with people. And I could never, I can try to articulate, and I always do try to articulate why I make what I make. But there's something inarticulable, that's totally not a word, inexpressible about what I make, and that's why I paint it. So you have to look at the painting to get it. And some people will and some people won't, and as an artist you have to accept that not everyone will connect. You don't want everyone to connect, because if everyone connects, it probably means that it's oversimplified and shallow.
If you're creating for everyone, you're creating for no one, I believe is what the saying is.
Yep. It's a business principle too. You know, if you try and get everyone, you get no one.
I like that you brought up the aspect of learning through doing as opposed to listening, because that speaks to something that we often don't take into account when we're trying to do something or learn something new, is what is going to be the best way for me to absorb this, as opposed to this is how it is and this is how you have to do it.
Yeah. Well, again, going back to, you know, you can probably notice that my master's degree is in education, but there are lots of different learning styles. Howard Gardner, who's down at Harvard, you know, kind of coined the concept of multiple intelligences, which is that some people are audio learners, some people are visual, some people are spatial. And one of the most important things you can do for yourself with growth as a human being in mind is to learn how you learn. And too often is in our culture, which is so focused on kind of logical based learning. So whether it's numerical or through reading and writing, we assume that that is the only way people learn. But it's not. And so many people are lost in both the education system and then later in their professions, because we assume that everyone should communicate in these ways. There's a great New Yorker cartoon, which I actually used in my master's thesis, because I went to art school, so you could put cartoons in your thesis. but it's that image of like a whole series of animals lined up in front of a guy sitting in a desk, and it's an elephant and a monkey and a dog and a fish in a fishbowl and a bird. And the guy says, okay, to pass the test, you have to climb that tree. And it's just, oh, I love it. It's just education system in a nutshell. It's just what we expect in a nutshell, that, you know, of course some people can climb a tree and some people can't. Of course some people read really fast and some people don't. And I think learning that, it also helps you figure out what art form is best for you. You know, I learned really quickly that realistic, you know, specific drawings are not my forte. It's not how I learn. It's not how I think. Whereas kind of bright, colorful abstractions, that's how my brain works, and that's how I can best express myself.
How does someone figure out what they or the best method for learning?
I mean, from a very dry point of view, there are tests. I mean, Howard Gardner has tests that you take that will tell you what your intelligence is, what kind of intelligence you have. And I actually had a really incredible science teacher when I was in sixth grade. She was also my advisor, and she had us all take the test and then talk to us about what it meant that we had this different kind of learning. So that is, is kind of the easy answer. You know, the harder answer is just to experiment, to get out there. And, you know, I learned pretty quickly in college that if I just sit and listen to a lecture, I won't absorb anything. I actually learned that when I was in art history. I realized that I never needed to look at my tests to study. I have a really good memory. I never needed to look at my notes. And so I was like, oh, well, if I never need to look at my notes, maybe I just don't need to take notes. It was a terrible idea. Because I realized that the way I learn is by writing, is through the movement of writing and the visual recognition of the words that I've written. And so when I wrote down what I was listening to, I remembered it. And I never had to look at what I'd written. It wasn't for recall later. It was actually the act of writing that made me learn, which I realized through trial and error, because I decided, oh, I never look at my notes, so I don't need to take notes. And then I had to go back and read that entire chapter of the art history textbook.
Cool. Yeah, it's very interesting to figure out what works and what doesn't. And people, I think, are afraid of failure, so they aren't willing to experiment. And that's a big part of learning. So just being able to fail and see what works and what doesn't is how you grow.
Absolutely. And that's, there's a whole section of my book, Don't Make Art, Just Make Something, which focuses on failure and the importance of failure. And, you know, pretty much every obnoxious entrepreneur book out there also talks about the importance of failure. The best quote that I heard about it was from John Maeda when he was the president of RISD. And he says, being prepared isn't a matter of how much you practice. It's about knowing that even if you fail, you won't give up. And I think that kind of sums up failure better than any other words that I've ever read. Because you will always fail. You will never be so good that you are, you know, invulnerable to failure. And so the true expert, the true wise man, the true sage knows how to keep going even when they fail.
Yeah, it's learning from your mistakes and figuring out what you need to learn more of and what you can do to learn better.
Mm-hmm.
What is the next step in Miranda's Hearth? Because you have these meetings, but how close are you to actually building the hotel?
Well, we are literally building the first room right now. So this goes back to my concept of just starting with something. Now that I have the community, now that I have a really strong, dedicated following, I spent the past, 4 months now, building a tiny house on the front lawn of the Art Center where I currently work. And the goal for this house is that not only is the process of building it being highlighted in a public art project, it will be filled with handmade items. And in the long run, it will be used as a hotel room in Miranda's Hearth. So our goal is to be finished by June of 2016. And then I'll live in it for a year or two while I'm searching for the land to do Miranda's Hearth. And I already have some meetings lined up with city planners and local towns to see if they'd be interested in bringing this concept to their town. So once the tiny house is finished and I'm living in it, I'll find that piece of land, hopefully within a year or two, and then we'll dive in full steam ahead and we'll start developing the actual hotel. And in the meantime, we'll continue the events. This year we started a book club that meets once a month. We started a fiber arts group. Next year, we're starting a monthly waltzing night. You know, so we're trying to create these avenues for people to engage with the community. I noticed that the dinner art and music nights are really comfortable for a lot of extroverts because it's a lot of people in the room talking and making things. But the people in my community who are more introverted were not always as comfortable. And that's why we started these smaller groups. That's why we started a book club. That's why we started the fiber arts group. Because I want to make Miranda's Hearth approachable. I want to make it accessible to as many different kinds of people as possible. Of course, always acknowledging that if you make it open to everyone, no one comes. But but yeah, so the next step is to finish this tiny house that we decided to build. And after that, to find the land and find the community who will help me take this crazy enormous idea of mine and turn it into an actual staple of a community.
I wanted to bring this up earlier, but I completely forgot. What happened on your trip to El Salvador?
Oh, so I went and I was younger than everyone there by at least 8 years. So I was just kind of tottering along in the wake of everyone else. And it was led by a woman named Claudia Bernardi. She's a community artist who teaches out in California. She runs a program called Walls of Hope, and she paints murals all across the world. She's worked with, you know, international communities up in Canada. She's worked with rape survivors in Guatemala. She's worked with people from the Desparecidos in Argentina. And she was the one who led this trip to El Salvador that I was on. And it was a 10-day spring break trip. But before we went, she made us learn the history particularly the recent history of El Salvador, which was, thrown into a pretty terrible civil war in the 1970s and 1980s, which, of course, you know, the States was part of and on the wrong side of, really, if you look at history. And so we went to this little rural town in the mountains of El Salvador, and we were painting a mural on this one-room library that had a bookcase with a couple books in it. And it was really inspiring to see the people come and work with us, the light that the art brought to the community. But the most transformative part for me was a visit to a town called El Mazote. And El Mazote was kind of right on the edge of the guerrilla territory and the government territory during the Civil War. And the government thought that this town was supporting the guerrillas because they were technically in guerrilla territory. But the town was trying really hard to be impartial. You know, of course, they gave supplies to guerrillas and they gave supplies to the government because you got to sell stuff to live. And then in, I think it was, gosh, let's see if I can still remember this. December 10th of 1981, a troop of government officials came to El Mazote. And of course, this troop was trained by Americans, and they massacred the entire town of over 1,000 people, all the women, children, and men. And there was one survivor out of this entire attack. And we read her, Claudia, who worked with us, knew the woman, Rufina Amaya, who survived the attack. And we read the account, her account of that night. And then we went to that town, and this was, I don't know, 20 years later, 15 years later, and it was still empty houses ridden with bullets. And there were a couple of people coming back to the town, but it was mostly young children and, you know, grandparents, and you could just see the entire generation that was missing. And Claudia got to know this town because her sister was on the Argentinian forensic squad that went in 1993 for the UN to excavate the site of the massacre, which, of course, had been just swept under the rug. A lot of the massacre took place in a church, and so they excavated the church. And Claudia came back later, and she helped rebuild the site of the massacre. She created this beautiful mural, bright, colorful mural with children dancing, and along the bottom of it were the names of all of the victims. And in the specific area, the children had been separated from the adults, and there was the names and all of their ages. And next to this mural was a part of the bullet-ridden floor of the original church, surrounded by a garden that had been turned into El Jardín de Paz, which means the Garden of Peace. And I remember I was 15 and I was sitting in the dirt, and I found the children who were my age when they were massacred in their own church. And I could see the bullets on the floor. And standing above this was Claudia talking about creating the mural with the people who had come back and creating a sculpture and a memorial that said El Mazote Nunca Más, or El Mazote Never Again. And I spent that afternoon playing hand games with the children who were there and looking at the art and weeding, actually, the garden with one of the men who had come back. And it was at that moment that I realized how vital art is, that it's not just million-dollar pieces hanging on a museum wall behind a piece of glass. That, you know, cliche as it sounds, it literally builds communities. It brings people back together. It brings meaning to life. And that was the moment when I realized that I didn't want to dedicate my life to pursuing some gallery position, selling artwork to the 1%. You know, I wanted to help rebuild. I wanted to help create connection. And I saw art as the vehicle. For me, art has always been a vehicle. It is not a purpose in and of itself. I do recognize that for some people it is, And I think the work that they make is beautiful. But for me, art is the means and human connection and finding meaning through life. That's the purpose. That's what art helps us do. And that moment in El Salvador, it was one day. And it's why I'm doing what I'm doing. And it's why I've never strayed off the path. And it's why I never think I will, because it's important. It's important in the darkest of places, and it's also important in the lightest of places to remember that, that creativity reminds us why we're here.
Wow. That's a great story, and it speaks to the power of, like, an event or a choice encounter that can completely affect your entire life and how powerful certain moments can be. So you never know how much of an impact either you're going to make or something you do is going to make on other people in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think and art is a perfect capture of that. When I was working at the Museum of Fine Arts, I would often think to myself, you know, what fifth grader is going to care that they saw the Infanta Maria Teresa? Like, but then I remember, you know, the moments that shaped me, the people who, I don't remember the woman who led the tour when I went to the Gardner for the first time, but man, I remember that museum. I remember every detail of it. And I spent years trying to get back to it. And I was 10 the first time I went. So I think that story and others remind me that everything you do makes an impact, and it might not be huge and it might not be remembered and you might not be remembered, but the concept might be, you know, but it makes you live much more intentionally to be aware that everything you do has an impact on someone or something, or at least that it could, the possibility of impact is there.
I have a few more questions left.
Yeah.
What is a quote that speaks to you as a person and something that you live your life after or you aspire to be or something that has affected your life?
So I think one of the ways that I live my life can be encapsulated by a quote from Elizabeth Gilbert, who gave just an absolutely fantastic talk. TED Talk called Your Elusive Creative Genius. And in it, she's talking about how to maintain your creativity. You know, she had a best-selling book, Eat, Pray, Love, when she was 40. And she said, well, now what? You know, so it sent her down this path to explaining what creativity was and trying to figure it out. And she says, I'm not a pipeline. I'm a mule. And the way that I have to work is I have to get up at the same time every day and sweat and labor and barrel through it incredibly awkwardly. And one of the things I write about this in my book, and I talk a lot about it in my community and my events, is that we've created this really harmful story of what it means to be an artist in our culture. She talks a lot about it in that TED Talk, about how we've called ourselves geniuses. We talk about inspiration striking. We make it seem like these, you know, impulses, genius impulses coming from natural inborn talents, when really what it comes down to, what art comes down to, what grand projects come down to is effort, is putting in the time. And people don't want to hear that. You know, they don't want to hear that it takes time, that it takes endless, repetitive, obnoxious, menial tasks to get anywhere. That, you know, yes, I get to host these fantastic events with fantastic people, but I spend so much time sending emails to people and setting up spreadsheets and doing, you know, the background. And if you're a good artist, most people don't see that. You know, they see the inspiration, they read the masterpiece, they listen to the song, and they don't recognize, our culture doesn't recognize the effort that it takes. And one of the things I want to do in my community is help tell the stories of effort.
That's good. I don't know if you've listened to her podcast, Magic Lessons, but it's
no.
She has a very good podcast, and she just talks to a bunch of different artists, some famous, some not, and talks about what it means to be an artist. It is really cool.
Oh, I'll have to check that out. I know I have to read her latest book. I think it's called Big Magic. It's probably along the same lines, which came from TED Talk. Yeah, she's doing the work, I think, the really important work of acknowledging the effort, of acknowledging what it takes.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a morning routine? And if you do, what is it?
I do, but it's really boring. I'm a very habitual person. I go to bed at almost the same time every night. I wake up at the same time almost every day. But it's really just like a get ready routine. There's nothing artistic about my morning. More interesting, I suppose, is probably before I go to bed every night, I write in my journal, and it's not, honestly, it's not particularly interesting. I don't think any journals really are, in the long run. It's just a daily record, but I've written in it every single night since March 23rd, 2007. Huh. So it's been about 8.5 years, and I have, God, I have like 26 journals already. It's ridiculous.
Wow.
But, yeah, 8.5 years adds up pretty freaking quick. But I think that's probably the most habitual thing that I have related to creativity, is that I write in that every night. And I wrote about that actually in Don't Make Art, Just Make Something. It's that I knew I could write a book because I've filled 26 books. And sure, you know, nobody will ever read them and nobody will ever care. But the way you fill up a book is that you write a page every night. And eventually it fills, even though you feel like it'll never happen and it'll never get done. And so I think, again, the writing itself, just like when I was talking about the art history class, is not important. But the act of writing is just irreplaceable.
Yeah, and the, like Elizabeth Gilbert said, they just doing the work where you're just constantly at it. And it might not be a product within itself, but the result from it is something that you can pull out anytime, anywhere, as long as you have it, and remember or learn from what you've already gone through.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I mean, the act of writing has actually made my writing much better. And for the most part, I hope people won't read my journal. but my voice as a writer has become so much clearer just because I've done it every night. You know, it's, again, it's the effort, it's the repetition, it's the unglorified hours that make the background to any true masterpiece.
Mm-hmm. This is one of my favorite questions, because this is how I found you through Dory Clark. It's who is somebody that you know personally that is really creative, and then somebody that you don't know personally?
Who is also really creative?
Yeah.
Gosh. I want to give you like a list of like 40 people, and I mostly want to give you people who don't recognize themselves as creative just to force them to acknowledge that they are. My mind is just running through my list of like the 15 founding members of Miranda's Hearth, who are all there for different reasons, but who are all really important to the community as a whole and who all bring creativity in a different form. I don't know if I could really pick one of them. I guess, I've already mentioned him already, so I can bring up Ryan Bonaparte, who wrote a book called The Book Crazy Enough to Try, and who, you know, is an engineer, but that is actually incredibly creative, and he's one of the most thoughtful people that I know. And then kind of on the opposite end, there's another member of Miranda's Hearth, whose name is Kara Kupla, and she's a musician. And she's very comfortable with her high levels of creativity. She's an incredible musician. And she just gets out there in the world and she does it and she makes things.
And other than Elizabeth Gilbert, I guess, who is somebody that you think is creative that you don't know?
Kind of like in a mentor way.
Sure.
I don't know. Gosh, that's a really hard question.
If you could step into somebody's shoes, just to see how their mind works, who would that be?
I mean, I guess the person who I am always most fascinated by and who I refer to is Sir Ken Robinson. He was literally knighted for his work in creativity and education, and he's just freaking brilliant. So either him or the other one that I've been reading a lot of lately is Brené Brown, who talks about shame and vulnerability. And it's funny, she's not as direct a connection to creativity, but I think what she talks about is really important as far as creativity, and the way she approaches those concepts is also incredibly important, both for artists and more broadly.
Cool. What are some books, podcasts, documentaries, or any tools that people that you would recommend to people?
Gosh, is it cheating to just read the bibliography from my book? Because
if you want,
I'm not actually going to read it to you, but that concept, more or less, what it is. We mentioned Austin Kleon already, his book Feel Like an Artist. We mentioned Elizabeth Gilbert and her TED Talk and the book that came out of it. Another great one is The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield. I have a couple quotes from him that I really enjoy. And then kind of on a more businessy side, there's Making Ideas Happen by Scott Belsky. And he really focuses on art administration and how to get artists out there, how to get them creating things. So I guess those are my go-tos. And of course, Ken Robinson, his TED Talk on Why Schools Kill Creativity, absolutely phenomenal. One of the most watched TED Talks. And then last, I guess, is John Maeda, who I mentioned his quote earlier. He also gave a great talk and then wrote a book called Redesigning Leadership, where he talks about approaching leadership from a new point of view.
Cool. Those are all good ones. What advice would you give to people who want to make more out of their creativity?
I guess it's always figuring out how to make it manageable, how to break it down, how to turn it into, you know, don't make art, just make something. How to make it a little piece that can fit into your life in some routine way. I think habits are actually incredibly important. Routine is incredibly important as far as establishing creativity in your life. You know, I think if you walk into a museum and you think, God, I couldn't do that, you won't. But if you walk into a museum and you say, God, I really wish I could learn how to draw a figure. How do I figure out how to draw a figure? And then you find a class. And then you learn how to draw a foot for 3 weeks like you do in figure drawing classes. Then you move on to hands. And, you know, that's how you learn how to do it. You take some big concept and you break it down into bite-sized pieces. And if you just don't know what the bite-sized pieces are, my best recommendation is always writing. Stream of thought writing. Just getting it out there. Just making yourself create. And it'll be crap. You know, it usually is. But if you keep making it, you find little pieces inside. And I think, gosh, who did this quote? Forget who. I know Elizabeth Gilbert quotes it, but she says, inspiration shows up, but it has to find you working. You know, you're not going to get struck by lightning if you're not out in the field.
Right. And my last question is, what is your definition of creativity and what can people do to be more creative?
Definition of creativity. Um, I think it's paying attention. I think it's being curious and then following up on that curiosity. So much of creativity is just trying. It's just combining things in new ways and making things show up in a different form. And to be more creative, you have to be willing to take those risks. You have to be willing to try new things. You have to be willing to be uncomfortable and to sit with what makes you feel uncomfortable. I think one of the best concepts I had recently, another great quote, which I wish I could repeat verbatim, was from an interview with Terry Goss from This American Life. And she said that, you know, artists are the people who society assigns to sit and consider their lives so that we can all learn from it. And I think that's what creativity is. I think that's what it takes, is just consideration, just sitting down and breathing into it and then taking the leap and seeing where it takes you.
That's a great definition. Well, Miranda, it's been really awesome talking to you. I think you have a lot of great ideas on creativity, and people can learn a lot from what you've done and what they can do themselves from what you've done. Where can people keep up to date with what you're doing and what you'll be doing in the future?
The best place is mirandashearth.com, hearth like the fireplace. We have an email list. I send out updates every Monday about the upcoming hearth events and where the tiny house is and what's coming next. So we make it really easy for you to stay in touch and stay connected, because, you know, that's the point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, thanks again for coming on. It's been really fun talking
Absolutely.
To you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a lot of fun sharing my rambling stories.
All right, bye.
And that's it for the 51st episode of Cracking Creativity. For show notes, go to crackingcreativity.org/51. If you like this episode, subscribe to the show on iTunes at crackingcreativity.org/subscribe. Also, feel free to write a review or leave me a comment about the show. Hope this stoked your creative fires, and I'll see you next time on Cracking Creativity.